On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! I knew I forgot something. Hey, is the audio any better? I hope it is. Happy, happy on the streaming computer now. It's got a fresh copy of Windows 7 running on it and seems to be behaving nicely with a new battery on the motherboard. And, well, it certainly could have been worse. Knock wood. Yeah, that's my head. Welcome to Titanic Tuesday on the Horn. And I think we'll have a lovely time of it this evening. But I want to start out before we jump into the seemingly endless list of Titanic idiots who infect our world. I think it more than apropos to begin the program this evening by noting the passing of a great American. Oh, yes, 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 yes. I'm sure we'll talk about the State of the Union at some point this evening. And my goodness gracious, it will be a powerful speech. The president, not sure, delivers a really good speech. And that being the case, yeah, I've got the door unbolted in case I have to run screaming into the night when he mentions clean coal technology or something equally odious or makes some sort of equivocating statement about the needs of profit versus the needs of people to be able to go on living on the planet. Yeah. But like I said, I think it is more than appropriate to note the passing of Pete Seeger. Because Pete Seeger was ever so much more than simply, if simply can ever be used to apply to such a person, simply a musician. I don't think there's any such thing as simply a musician or simply an artist. Because it takes into account far too much of the human condition to be simply a musician. And Pete Seeger lived his life with a vision of the potential for a country, this country, to be great, and with a vision toward a common humanity that was much less tolerant of hate and suffering. Because tolerating hate and tolerating suffering are, you know, two of the places where tolerance is not a good thing. For everyone, and I know it's not folks among the Horn Family Commune, but for everyone who thinks that Pete Seeger was defined only by his music, some words. Some words from Pete Seeger from 1955. Words from Pete Seeger from 1955 when he was hauled in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee. The communist witch hunt, the barefaced attempt by the right wing in this country to suppress all dissent. an inquisition that was founded on a tissue paper of lies, for the most part. Called before the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1955, Pete Seeger said the following: I am not going to answer any questions as to my association, my philosophical or religious beliefs, or my political beliefs, or how I voted in any election, or any of these private affairs. I think these are very improper questions for any American to be asked, especially under such compulsion as this. If he had done no other thing with his life, if there had been no music, if he had not stood in solidarity with so many people involved in so many grassroots struggles and been on the right side of them, whether it be the environment or civil rights or poverty or the right to organize, if he had done nothing else but make that statement in front of those filthy, filthy, filthy people in the House Un-American Activities Committee, the 94 years that he spent on this planet would have been magnificently spent nonetheless. I am not going to answer any questions as to my association, my philosophical or religious beliefs, or my political beliefs, or how I voted in any election, or any of these private affairs. I think these are very improper questions for any American to be asked, especially under such compulsion as this. And such are the kinds of statements that come from a life lived writ large. It's worth keeping that in mind. But of course, there was the music. There was the revival of the history of the music that had sprawled out across this continent. Charlie Pierce said it best, I think, earlier today at his blog over at Esquire.com, that music is the language by which America talks to itself even when it has to whisper. And Pete Seeger gave life to a music that had largely been forgotten, and which, for all I know, under the present circumstances, has been re-forgotten. I just don't know. But sometimes that's the nature of art. It has to swell and retract in like some sort of wave form. But Pete Seeger's 94 years on this planet were indeed well spent. Probably more than any other song, this is what Pete Seeger is known for. And not just the first verse.
Walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land. this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled and followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts, while all around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. The sun came shining and I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving and the dust clouds rolling, and the fog was lifting and the voice was chanting, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Almost feels like a national anthem, doesn't it? Probably should be. But it might offend some, the delicate sensibilities of some old plutocrats, oligarchs, whatever. By the way, when I went to do my search just to pull up a little biographical information, I typed in, and this is one of those moments when you know that the culture is doomed, P-E-T-E, spacebar, S-E, and through the genius of internet predictive technology, oh really, get the duct tape and the tennis ball, this seems innocuous, but the longer it rolls around, the meaner it gets. P-E-T-E space S-E. I hadn't even gotten to the second E. And the fine folks I think my default browser, I mentioned this the other night, and people went, no! I just don't screw with this stuff. My default browser is Bing on this godforsaken Windows 8 machine. So I typed P-E-T-E space S-E, and before I could get to the second E, one of the first suggestions made was, no, really, sit down, duct tape, tennis ball, no open flames, nothing breakable anywhere near you, P-E-T-E space S-E, and brrrt. It populated, and one of the first things up was Pete Seeger, Night Moves. No, really. I wouldn't spring that on you as a joke. That's just a little... Little, too much for you. No, I couldn't make that up in a million years. Now, could I? No. By the way, after Pete Seeger said he wouldn't answer any questions about his politics or his beliefs or who he'd voted for or when he did that, well, It was March 26, 1957, when he was indicted for contempt of Congress. And Pete Seeger was, although most people probably don't know it, a political prisoner of sorts in this country. In 1961, he was convicted on the charge of contempt of Congress. He was sentenced to 10 years in jail. His conviction was overturned by an appeals court in May 1962. But in the intervening years, he had to report to the federal government any time he left the Southern District of New York. Lest we forget. Yes, Marty. Night Moves is from Bob Seger, who would not have been fit to carry the extra set of banjo strings for Pete Seeger's banjo, but, you know, what the hell. Question coming in from Ron and Raleigh. Which one, hey Bob. Which one of the aforementioned filthy right-wingers will yell out at tonight's speech, "Negro, you lie"? I'm not laying odds. I think this is one of those where the point spread is less than three, and the bookies just call it a pick 'em. So yeah. Pete Seeger, Night Moves. But there was a lot of... he had a tremendous impact on music, from the Byrds to Joan Baez to the Seekers. But probably the most surprising, and I was not aware of this until today, the most surprising thing that I ran across was this. And, I mean, you want to talk about an international impact. This is just pretty beautiful. 1962, Marlene Dietrich.
La chanson que je vais vous chanter est une chanson américaine pour laquelle Rousseau a écrit les paroles françaises. Mais comme je vais chanter en allemand, je vais vous dire de quoi la chanson parle. Où sont parties toutes les fleurs? Les jeunes filles sont venues, les ont cueillies. Et où sont allées les jeunes filles? Vers les jeunes hommes. Et où sont allés les jeunes hommes? Ils sont allés à la guerre. Et où sont allés les soldats? Aux tombes. Sag mir, wo die Blumen sind. Wo sind sie geblieben? Sag mir, wo die Blumen sind. Was ist geschehen? Sag mir, wo die Blumen sind. Mädchen pflückten sie geschwind. Wann wird man je verstehen? Wann wird man je verstehen? Sag mir, wo die Mädchen sind. Wo sind sie geblieben? Sag mir, wo die Mädchen sind. Was ist geschehen? Sag mir, wo die Mädchen sind. Männer nahmen sie geschwind. Wann wird man je verstehen? wann wird man je verstehen? Sag mir, wo die Männer sind, wo sind sie geblieben? Sag mir, wo die Männer sind, was ist geschehen? Sag mir, wo die Männer sind, zogen vor der Kriegbeginn. Wann wird man je verstehen? Wann wird man je verstehen? Sag, wo die Soldaten sind, wo sind sie geblieben? Sag, wo die Soldaten sind, was ist geschehen? Sag, wo die Soldaten sind, über Gräbern weht der Wind. Wann wird man je verstehen? Wann wird man je verstehen? Sag mir, wo die Gräber sind, wo sind sie geblieben? Sag mir, wo die Gräber sind, was ist geschehen? Sag mir, wo die Gräber sind, Blumen blühen im Sommerwind. Wann wird man je verstehen? Wann wird man je verstehen? Sag mir, wo die Blumen sind, wo sind sie geblieben? Sag mir, wo die Blumen sind, was ist geschehen? Sag mir, wo die Blumen sind, Mädchen pflückten sie geschwind. Wann wird man je verstehen? Wann wird man je verstehen?
That's 1962. That's the 1962 that gave us the Cuban Missile Crisis. A few years later, the Byrds would record Turn, Turn, Turn. And a new line of thinking? A new consciousness of the hellish brutality and outright stupidity of war would begin to take hold. It has not That consciousness has not sunk a taproot yet, but it's still alive. And you can't help but think in 1962, maybe, just maybe, there was a damned good reason for rendering Flowers, or Where Have All the Flowers Gone, into German. A very good reason indeed for people who were not that far gone from trying to sort out just exactly what had happened to their country and to the world. And a decent human being who outlasted all the people who despised him. Wait, Henry Kissinger's still alive, isn't he? Damn! Oh well, almost all the people who despised him. Well, he made 94 years count. Pete Seeger once told, I forget, I don't know whom, but someone asked him, and you know, why people ask questions like this, I do not know. But I guess because this country is largely one that is imbued with a sense of religious insanity. Somebody asked him about his religion. And while he was not willing to answer that in front of a bunch of hypocritical punks on the House Un-American Activities Committee. He did give an interview, an answer to his interviewer. He said, I feel most spiritual when I'm out in the woods. I feel part of nature or looking up at the stars. I used to say I was an atheist. Now I say it's all according to your definition of God. According to my definition of God, I'm not an atheist because I think God is everything. Whenever I open my eyes, I'm looking at God. Whenever I'm listening to something, I'm listening to God. And I can imagine that he was indeed very much welcome at the Unitarian Universalist congregation he attended in New York State. And who's to argue with that? Well, nobody. And that's the whole point. Transcending something like that is maybe, just maybe, a mark of humanity. And maybe he had a little bit more of it than a lot of other folks. So I just wanted to, and maybe we'll play a couple more Pete Seeger tracks as the evening progresses. But I just wanted to get that out there by way of, I mean, I don't like doing obituaries, but this man was truly important, at least in the way I gauge importance. Sadly, most of the people that history remembers are people who managed to kill a lot of other human beings. It's said that Julius Caesar had a promising career as a writer and a poet, but we don't remember him for that, and most of his writings beyond the Gallic Wars are gone. And I don't have to mention some, well, Tamerlane, Saladin. You get the idea. Richard the Lionhearted. Edward the Black Prince. Andrew Jackson. And no small number of Asian generals who were really, really good at slaughter. They get to be remembered down through history. Maybe the beginning of a new stage of humanity comes from letting history pay a little more attention to the folks who didn't slaughter millions. You know, the fact that we've managed to hang on to Shakespeare's memory for 400 years is pretty important. And I think there's a decent chance that the songs of Pete Seeger will be sung even by only a few, if only a few, 400 years from now. You can argue they'll probably be a little bit more accessible than the plays of Shakespeare. Kind of unusual to see the phone ring right at the beginning of the program, but it did happen, so I hate to keep people sitting on hold. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. It's Kevin from Brooklyn, but currently in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, Cap, my goodness gracious. Kevin, how are you?
I know. It's been a while. A long while. Too long. It's one of the few sleepless nights that I have. Usually when you're there's like an 8-hour gap between your air time and my sleep time. But, you know, this is just a unique moment altogether. Usually I'm asleep now.
Well, I'm sorry you're sleepless, but I'm glad that you're putting it to good use.
I'm sleepless over good things. I'm getting ready to go to Ireland on Thursday, tomorrow here, 2 days.
Nice.
2 days from now, yeah, so I'm kind of excited.
So are you still doing the teaching gig?
Yeah, yeah. It's going on year four, and hopefully my new wife and I, Andrea, can be out here in Saudi for another 2-3 years, and then, as they say, hit halas, you know, that's it. Call it a wrap and settle in South Africa.
You know? Wow. So just for those who may not recall, you'd been in Florida, you'd been in the D.C. area, you went back and sort of regrouped back at your home in Brooklyn. Left there, went to teach in China, went to teach in South Korea, and have now made your way to Saudi Arabia. And along the way, found common cause with someone that you chose to marry, which is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it is. And I tell you, if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't have lasted. Saudi Arabia, ironically enough, has been the most difficult, but also the longest place we've been in.
Well, I was going to ask Kevin, if you don't mind giving a bit of a travel log, what your thoughts are on the relative merits of the places you've been.
Well, the easiest place was South Korea. That was my first place. The easiest place was South Korea. You know, you go through culture shock through all of them. You know, you go through the adjustment and culture shock of all of them. The easiest place by far was South Korea. And, reason being, I think Koreans may be more used to having Americans there because there are like over 50,000 U.S. troops there. So even the most remote, smallest part of Korea, they've seen as one foreigner. And to a certain degree, Korean culture is accessible to Americans because there are plenty of Korean Americans. Yeah. Who are first generation. So there's a level of familiarity. This may not sound particularly politically correct, but they often refer to Korea as the poor man's Japan, and Americans are very familiar to a certain degree, as Americans can be, with Japanese culture. So the two cultures are very similar from a Western eye. You know, between them, they'll say they're very different, but from a Western eye. So I'd say Korea was the easiest. China, living situation was a lot better, but China's difficulties were basically, it's just overwhelmingly huge and big. And this is coming from a New Yorker. And, hello?
Yeah, I'm right here. I'm right here.
Yeah. And this is coming from a New Yorker saying that, you know, Shanghai is just overwhelmingly huge. And
well, I remember a long time ago there was a little film strip type video that I think premiered at Sundance called Ha 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 America that made a lasting impression on me. And it pointed out the fact that even a city as large as New York is a rounding error some places in China.
Yeah. Well, but that holds true for any Asian city. New York is like a cow town compared to, like, even your average size Asian city. You know, I've been to about 6 Asian countries, and it's New York is nothing compared to them.
Now you realize you're liable to raise the ire of the New Yorkers by saying that.
Well, I don't mean it. Well, here's where New York beats the mountains in cultural diversity, though. Yeah, and that's where New York, and I'm saying that as a New Yorker, but just in size, you know, they will beat out New York.
I think you probably got out of China when the getting was good. If you look at the way things are deteriorating there, and I mean environmentally. I read a story the other day that there are places in China where giant like, you know, jumbotrons have been set up for the public. And they run, all they do is they run footage of the sunrise. Because the sun can no longer be seen to rise through the pollution.
Well, yeah, well, the part of the reason why I had to leave China was because I got sick in China. Because of the pollution. I think that was probably the last time I spoke to you when I kind of came back for about a month in New York to regroup, a month and a half, and then went to Saudi Arabia. I got sick in China.
Well, I remember, and that was about the last time I heard from you, because, and you had gotten ill, and frankly, we worried some.
Yeah, I lost like 2 units of blood. Mysteriously, it's like, you know, your hemoglobin, my hemoglobin got damaged, and it wasn't producing enough vitamin B12, and that was due from like the pollution and bad food and things in China. I'm okay now, but it was kind of scary because for like 2 hours, it might have been speculated I might have had leukemia or something like that. You know?
Damn.
So that, yeah. And you're right, I did get out while the getting was still good because 6 months later, the main water source in Shanghai, which is, I forgot the name of the river now, found like 12,000 floating pigs in the river. So, yeah, we were glad to get out of China.
I can well imagine. I just found out from the chat room that the whole Chinese jumbotron thing was a hoax. So I retract that. But
it's okay. But a lot of things in China, a lot of things in like this industry, you're gonna get like urban legends.
Yeah. You know? Well, but it is not an urban legend that many of the cities are being choked in their own pollution, is it not?
Oh yes. Oh yes. Oh yeah. That is definitely the deal. Oh yeah. But it wouldn't surprise me if it did exist in China either. It wouldn't surprise me at all.
Well, I just had a note roll in from Kate out in Montana. She said, "Kevin, you were conjured. I've been sending you energy and good thoughts for many months. Glad to hear you're doing well. Keep in touch more often. All the best, Kate."
I'll try. You know, I'll try. It's like when you're on. I listen to your podcast. Because I said, when you're alive, I'm usually in bed, you know, because of the time difference. Yeah, sorry about that. But, hey.
No. Don't. Yeah. No, that's the beauty of new media. People listen when they want to listen.
Yeah.
I'm just happy to have folks listening.
Yeah. And, you know, I miss you. And even that time, it's like I have to take a break. And I think I've discussed this with you before. It's no disrespect towards you or the show. It's just
it becomes difficult.
Yeah,
it's
and
hard.
And also,
go ahead.
Yeah. Now, also, it's like, you know, living here in Saudi Arabia, it's like it also has its own share of, you know, difficulties. So it, you know, to do both, you know, it's quite difficult.
I can well imagine.
Yeah.
I'm surprised. Yeah. I'm surprised I'm not firewalled over there.
Yeah.
But so you're going to go and spend a couple of days in Ireland then?
Yeah, we're going to spend 9 days. We have a short holiday, and we decide to go to Ireland. And then come back, do 4 months, and we have like what they call the Ramadan break, which is about 6-7 weeks. I'll probably go back to New York, you know, to family for 2, and then go to South Africa, you know, because pretty much my home base is now Cape Town. My home base is Cape Town.
Well, you have certainly become a citizen of the world.
Oh yes.
If I can ask, I mean, are you still maintaining your U.S. citizenship?
For now, yes. For now, yes. And the thing is, in all practicalities, it's still there. You know, I put 20-some-odd years into Social Security.
Right.
You know, if it's still there, I want to get it. You know. But pretty much our home base is Cape Town. If, you know, which can happen any day, being in the part of the world that I am, if we have to all of a sudden bug out, Cape Town would be where we're heading to, not New York. You know. So that is an option. And it's a nice place to be, you know. Like South Africa, it's a democracy, it's a young democracy, but like things that Americans have taken for granted, they don't. You know, they don't in Cape Town. In South Africa, not just Cape Town. In South Africa. So, it's like an election is coming up, and they're pretty excited.
So, how big a class do you teach there?
I'll see 20 men because it's strictly males, and my wife, she teaches the females because of the segregation of sexes.
Wow. And you've been doing that how long?
Well, I've been in Saudi Arabia for over 2 years now. And, you know, Korea, I did a year. China, I did a year. Saudi Arabia, 2 years. And I would tell anyone who thinks about teaching in Saudi Arabia, first I'll tell them against it, then I'll say, go someplace else, teach. If you couldn't deal with that, then come to Saudi Arabia.
Wow.
Yeah. Then come to Saudi Arabia. It's not an easy place, but if you want to achieve certain goals in life, within a relatively short period of time, this is the place you can do it. And that's what basically what I'm doing here.
Have you done much traveling in the region?
No. Well, I haven't traveled in Saudi Arabia, but I've been to Bahrain, Emirates, Qatar.
Yeah, that's kind of what I meant, generally speaking.
Yeah. But again, those are just weekend getaways, just to take a break from Saudi. You know, where you can have a little glass of something, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, exactly.
And see a movie and all that. But even that, I'm starting to do less of because, you know, there are ways around that. I live in a compound now, so that helps. That helps. You know, we live in a compound. And that helps a lot because...
Are you working on acquiring any Arabic?
No, not really. I was learning through the industry that they kind of discourage the English teachers picking up the language or how would I say, I guess going native for lack of a better
term. Yeah, and that, well they want you teaching English immersively, I presume.
Yes, but more importantly is the culture and the English ways. One thing I have learned and accepted in all three countries is not so much learning the language more than learning the culture and just being things that you and I would take for granted. You know, for them it's very interesting. Yeah.
Well, the reason I asked about your American citizenship, Kevin, is because I can imagine our reputation is still rather sullied over there.
No, not really. Surprisingly enough.
Maybe not in the kingdom.
No, even in China. China, you would think China's the most anti-American country there is, but they, you know, love Americans, and they want American English. There's a huge demand, surprisingly so.
You know, one of the, there's a certain irony in you calling this evening, Kevin. One of the things that I just mentioned idly in passing last night was that I had just gotten done watching the short-lived sci-fi series Firefly, which I enjoyed immensely. But the future that it posits is one in which the two dominant languages of the spreading out of humanity into the cosmos are Chinese and English, and so you get a sort of 19th-century American-style English dialogue, periodically punctuated with little exclamations in Mandarin.
Oh, okay.
And it gave it a flavor of realism when you said they want to know American English. That was what I immediately thought of. So it's specifically American English. Is this for people who will then go on and maybe come and go to university in the U.S.? Is that the idea?
Pretty much, yeah, pretty much. Go to university in the U.S. or even in England, Canada, or South Africa, depending on the family and the sphere of influence. Because don't forget, China, like 100 years ago, was cut up into pieces by the various powers. So, like, in South China, like in Hong Kong, they're still very much into British English. And so it's all based on geography and the family, pretty much. But the rest of China was dominated by, you know, Russia, America, and all. So those areas tend to want North American English. So it depends on where you are in the family you come from.
Hearing all of this, Kevin, makes me halfway wish, well, not halfway, makes me wish I was a younger man.
I'm glad I did it the age I did it. I was pretty old when I did it. You know, I left the States when I was 39. And I'm going to be 44 this year.
You're staying.
There are guys your age, even older, who do this. A lot of them were very much a similar situation that I was. Basically starting over,
But there are also a lot of cautionary tales out there, are there not, Kevin? For people who want to do this sort of thing, there are unscrupulous companies that will solicit Americans to teach English. Are there not?
Yes, plenty. Basically,
I mean, how do you negotiate that? For lack of a better phrase, minefield.
Okay, well, this is why I say Korea is probably the best place to start. Korea or Japan, because it's highly regulated. Okay? Mm-hmm. And especially in Korea and Japan, you want to go into regular public schools, not the private academies or things like that. Start off in a regular public school, which is what I did. And then from there, as time goes by, you get to know it. And one thing you need to learn about, especially in the Far East, when one country does something, the others follow suit. If Japan decides to do something, Korea is going to follow, then eventually China will follow, and Thailand and Vietnam and so on and so forth. As much as they may try to distance themselves from one another, they all kind of dance to the same tune.
This just absolutely fascinates me.
Yeah. So it's just one of the things you got to know. The Middle East was kind of was a huge gamble on our part. When we decided to come here to Saudi Arabia. But we only planned on staying 6 months and then going back to China or Korea. it just so happened, you know, we decided to stay longer. And a big incentive is the money. It's not necessarily a lifestyle, but the money, you know, again.
They compensate for the lack of lifestyle with money.
Yes. Yeah. And, yeah, exactly. So it's just one of those things, you know, we do have our goals. And one thing I always tell people, don't get too comfortable in any situation when you teach English overseas, because that can change in a day. You know, always have an exit strategy, which our government comes from.
I think we lost Kevin. I'm sorry. That was fascinating and wonderful to hear from Kevin after so long. Because I do. I sit around. There are people we don't hear from for a while, and I think, gee, I hope they're okay. And every now and then I get an email or a phone call like this, and wow. So good luck, Kevin. Enjoy your holiday away, and enjoy your, enjoy seeing as much of this planet as you're seeing. Now, going back to, this story sort of dovetails. It's about a week old. It's out of the Wall Street Journal. Remember Eric Prince? Yeah, Eric Prince, the guy who set up Blackwater, who made a small fortune in sending mercenaries to Iraq and Afghanistan, didn't he? Probably, yeah. He has decided to throw his life. And remember, Eric Prince is a fundy of the worst order. Well, Eric Prince, super American, right, has decided to throw his lot in, interestingly, with the Chinese. You know, it used to be you had to say the communist Chinese. I think the Chinese are no more communists than we are. Authoritarian, oligarchic, absolutely. Fascistic, probably beyond a shadow of a doubt. The Wall Street Journal reports, in an article by David Fife, Eric Prince considers himself an accidental tourist whose modest business boomed after 9/11, expanded into Iraq and Afghanistan, and then was, in his words, blowtorched by politics. Nah, you know, the rotten, tawdry, filthy things that Blackwater operatives and, well, Eric Prince did had nothing to do with it, I'm sure. Right? Yeah. Well, he's in Hong Kong now, and he's being engaged by the Chinese to provide security logistics, I guess, for Chinese expansion into Africa. Now remember, this guy was a real live, honest-to-goodness patriot, right? Here are the words of the patriot. I would rather deal with the vagaries of investing in Africa than in figuring out what the hell else Washington is going to do to the entrepreneur next. Right, because Eric Prince defines entrepreneur as somebody who sends gunmen to unstable parts of the world. He weeps that Blackwater was completely thrown under the bus by a fickle customer, meaning the government of we the people. Yes, they were innocent victims, those heavily armed mercenaries. You betcha. I think we may have Kevin back. You still there, Kevin?
Yeah, I lost you. I'm sorry.
Oh, no worries. I'm, you know, this is kind of a miracle that I'm sitting here having a conversation with a guy sitting in Saudi Arabia anyway, so far be it from me to complain if the connection gets dodgy.
Yeah, Yeah. Well, yeah, it was an interesting thing with Blackwater. Yeah. You have those types around here too, living here too. You know. So, hey, I won't go into that conversation.
I can understand very well.
Yeah.
Well, I hate abrupt endings to conversations, but I'm glad you did call back. And all I can say is that I wish you well, and wherever next you decide to go, if it's not if you don't just rotate straight down to South Africa, if you go somewhere else, best of luck in your travels, and congratulations from the entire Horn Family Commune to you and your. How long have y'all been married? I was about to say new wife, but I mean, how long have y'all been married?
Yeah, a year and a half. It'll be 2 years this June.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, congratulations to you both. I hope you just stay wildly happy, and things are nothing but good for you all the way through.
Yeah, and we are, and it's been going so well. But thanks anyway. We can always use it because again, you never know in this universe.
Indeed, indeed.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Take care, Kevin, and travel safely.
Okay, then.
All right.
Okay. I won't be such a stranger next time.
Yeah, that would be nice. That would be nice. You know, just leave a note, tape it on the kitchen, tape it on the fridge in the kitchen, leave it on the kitchen table, whatever. But you know, just let us know you're okay.
Okay, then, bro.
All right.
Talk to you soon.
See you, Kevin. Bye now. That is it's quite a storied life he's made for himself. And it's got to be just, well, I don't know. I view everything through my own lens, and it would be nothing but amazing to see the things that Kevin has seen. Back to Eric Prince for just a minute. He was asked by the Wall Street Journal about his new endeavor on behalf of the Chinese in Africa. He says, "This is not a patriotic endeavor of ours. We're here to build a great business and make some money doing it. China has the appetite to take frontier risk, that expeditionary risk of going to these less certain, less normal markets and figuring out a way to make it happen. Critics can throw stones all they want. I've got a lot of experience in dealing in uncertainties in difficult places. This is a very rational decision, made, I guess, emotionless." Bull. There's no such thing as an emotionless decision made to make a heap of money. And by the way, those frontier risks, those expeditionary risks he's talking about the Chinese taking, you reckon there's anybody already living in the places where the expeditions will go to those frontiers? Why do you need a bunch of Eric Prince gun thugs? Well, you know why. Because capitalism and freedom and Jeebus and, of course, Wolverines! Yeah, you know darn good and well. Oh, goodness me. Well, let's take our break. And, of course, we've got it being Tuesday and all, the 28th of January, 2014. We've got the Green News Report on the way. I haven't mentioned over the course of this hour, so that means I've sort of stunted our chances by about an hour. But we started the evening hoping to raise $225. $225 either by PayPal or by the traditional mail address, you know, the Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318 Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801, or PayPal, either one. But 22 people, you know, we'll round down. We'll round up. 22 people at $10 a piece. 44 people at $5 a piece, 11 people at $20 a piece, 2 at $112.50. However you want to work it out, I just do that. just to show that I can do math on the fly, or at least simple division, maybe. That would be your gezintas, I believe. But anyway, that's what we need to do in order to stay even with finishing January something approaching normal levels. So anyway, the Green News Report is on the way. And after that, oh goodness me, we got lots to talk about. This is listener-supported conversation radio. This is The Horn. You know the number, 304-658-3333. Or on Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. Bob Kincaid Horn. Either way is fine if you want to jump into the conversation. We'll be right back.
Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake, Joe, by God, says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I ain't dead. Says Joe, but I ain't dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man. Says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, Joe says what they forgot to kill.
It's Tuesday, January 28, 2014.
There's a crater about 30 feet in diameter, about 10 feet deep.
TransCanada's natural gas pipeline explodes.
There has been an oil spill in the Delaware River in Delaware County.
Oil pipeline spills in Philadelphia. Plus,
that's our polar vortex.
Polar vortex.
Polar vortex.
It's a polar vortex redux making Alaska warmer than Florida.
All of that and more straight ahead. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Senators Bernie Sanders and Brian Schatz pushing TV networks to do more climate change stories. Should the government be telling the TV networks what's news?
Apparently someone's got to, Eric Bolling of Fox News.
And you know what? The media is already talking about this. If you turn on MSNBC or CNN, every single day they're talking about global warming. Americans are tired of hearing about this.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, we are celebrating our 10-year anniversary at bradblog.com this
Woo-hoo!
Week, and to celebrate, I went out and got food poisoning. So
I
will either be way more snarky than usual or way less snarky than usual today. I have no idea What do you have for us today?
Well, first off, it is the return of the polar vortex. Yet another blocking pattern in the jet stream is sending deep Arctic cold into the Midwest and South, pushing deep drought to California and crazy record warmth to Alaska. In Alaska, on Sunday night at 10 p.m., parts of Alaska were warmer than all of the continental U.S. except South Florida and Southern California. Got that?
In Alaska. And, of course, yes, everyone's got that. We see it all the time on CNN and MSNBC, who do nothing but cover global warming.
Right, and it might be nice for Alaskans, except that heat wave is triggering a series of some of the biggest avalanches ever observed in the region, like one that covered 52 miles of road near Valdez, Alaska.
Valdez, Alaska. Why does that word ring a bell for me?
Because it's the name of the Exxon Valdez, the oil tanker that spilled all over Alaska's pristine Prince William Sound.
Ah, yes, the Exxon Valdez. Well, I'm glad we learned our lesson from that 20 years ago and aren't transporting around dangerous oil and natural gas to have that kind of accident again, right?
No, I wish that were true. Oil and gas pipelines and infrastructure are blowing up all over the place.
A massive fireball and pipeline rupture burned for hours.
Just as temperatures plunged, a natural gas pipeline owned by TransCanada exploded in Manitoba, Canada, over the weekend.
Oh, it was like being at a bonfire, but the problem is we're a quarter mile away. It was as hot as that. It was intense heat.
That was intense heat from a quarter mile away. No one was hurt, and the cause of the explosion is still under investigation. TransCanada, the owner of that exploded pipeline, is the same pipeline company trying to build the controversial Keystone XL tar sands pipeline across the Midwest. This most recent exploded TransCanada pipeline has not been inspected by the company in over 5 years.
The southern leg of the TransCanada Keystone XL pipeline just opened, and you've got folks in Texas out there doing neighborhood watch to look at the pipeline because they say when these things explode or leak, it's usually people who find it, not the fancy schmancy computer equipment that TransCanada tells us is on their pipeline, so we don't need to worry.
Oil and gas infrastructure is really blowing up and wreaking havoc all over the place. Near Philadelphia,
there has been an oil spill in the Delaware River in Delaware County. Officials who were on the scene say that about 1,000 gallons of crude spilled into the water, the result of a broken pipe near Monroe Energy.
And interestingly, that oil pipeline was located right on the river. It's the second oil spill.
Okay, this doesn't seem to be getting any better. I need some sort of an indication, maybe a little something from the chat room. That appears to have been an audio defect in the file from Brad and Desi that was occurring, even as Brad said, fancy schmancy computer equipment. The goddess of irony is not always on our side. Yeah, see, we're back to normal now. I'll drop a note to Brad and Desi. I hate it that happened. Just as I was going to break and having covered the story of, what is the expeditionary force maintainer provider for frontier, we shoot horse thieves around here, stranger. Eric Prince, Ron and Raleigh wrote in, just time to queue up, Warren Zevon's Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner. Yeah. I think they're headed for the Central African Republic. Another country laboring under what is often referred to as the resource curse, where the more mineral and extractive riches a country has, the more the poorer you can expect the general population to be. We're kind of familiar with that notion around here. By the way, note from Asa in Vancouver. So interesting to hear from Kevin. I spent 3 years in the mid-90s in Dubai, Bob. What an experience. I wouldn't necessarily want to live there, but it was fun while it lasted. And a note from our buddy, the Angry Indian. A piece from Bertolt Brecht. Angry tells me it's his favorite. It's his favorite poem. And it's sort of in line with that, what I was saying about the people who managed to be remembered for a long time in history. A worker reads history. Who built the seven gates of Thebes? The books are filled with names of kings. Was it the kings who hauled the craggy blocks of stone? And Babylon, so many times destroyed, who built the city up each time? In which of Lima's houses, that city glittering with gold, lived those who built it? In the evening, when the Chinese wall was finished, where did the masons go? Imperial Rome is full of arcs of triumph. Who reared them up? Over whom did the Caesars triumph? Byzantium lives in song. Were all her dwellings palaces? And even in Atlantis of the legend, the night the seas rushed in, the drowning men still bellowed for their slaves. Young Alexander conquered India. He alone? Caesar beat the Gauls. Was there not even a cook in his army? Philip of Spain wept as his fleet was sunk and destroyed. Were there no other tears? Frederick the Great triumphed in the Seven Years' War. Who triumphed with him? Each page of victory, at whose expense the victory ball? Every 10 years a great man. Who paid the piper? So many particulars. So many questions. Bertolt Brecht. Of, among other works, the Threepenny Opera. I do believe. And that Caesar beat the Gauls line. I found this story very interesting. Regarding a DNA examination of the wisdom tooth of a European hunter-gatherer. The study was done at the Institute of Evolutionary Biology in Barcelona. And they were trying to take, they found a little bit of actual remaining DNA in the tooth and were able to analyze it and then compare it with the DNA of modern Europeans through, I presume, mitochondrial DNA, which is transmitted matrilineally only. Fascinating story. The subject lived in what is now Spain some 7,000 years ago, you know, right before the Earth was created, according to the fundies. And because of the genetic analysis that was performed, we know that he had blue eyes, his hair was either black or very dark brown, and his skin was quite dark, as in not white. And being as it is a 7,000-year-old wisdom tooth, we are not talking about the possibility, I suppose, even of him being, no, Neanderthal? No, quite human. Of course, Neanderthals, before the emails start rolling in, because this is, after all, the smartest radio audience on Earth, Neanderthals get a bum rap. I know that. The analysis goes on to point out that he was probably lactose intolerant and had more difficulty digesting starchy foods than later humans would after they had become sedentary and begun farming for precisely those starches. That's one of the things that comes with the advent of sedentary life and agriculture. The diet changes rather dramatically, or so I understand. But again, he had black to dark brown hair, blue eyes, and very dark skin. Now, when they went looking around to find out who his modern kinfolk are, hello, Sweden. Hello, Finland. Are we reaching? Yeah, them. Blue eyes weren't even thought to have come around for a while, I guess. But no, they were there apparently 7,000 years ago. Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. He was a cave dweller, or at least he was buried in a cave. high in the Cantabrian Mountains of northwest Spain. Two bodies were found in 2006 by some folks doing some caving. The two men were in their early 30s, and they had been very well preserved in the cool environment of the cave. Now, farming gets started in the Middle East, but it had not made it as far as, well, the Iberian Peninsula, among other places. So this guy was a hunter-gatherer. And I don't want to get too far afield, because whatever I was taught 1,000 years ago when I rode my dinosaur to class every day may not even be applicable anymore. But there's an argument to be made that that individual probably had a pretty decent life, that he may even have expended less energy in procuring his caloric intake than you and I expend today. Little things. His clothing was ornamented with reindeer teeth. Yeah. Neat, huh? They managed to reconstruct his entire genome. He had gene variants that tend to produce much, not just some, but much darker skin. Carlos Lalueza Fox said, "This guy had to be darker than any modern European, but we don't know how dark." And isn't it fascinating that out of all of this, that the headline on this is, "Ancient European had dark skin." Maybe it's a way of finally, we hope, putting to bed the idea of race. Of all the pernicious ideas that have so tenaciously hung on over the past couple or 300 years, the idea of race has got to be among the most pernicious. Right? Because that invention, out of whole cloth, has been used to, well, there's that line out of the Eric Prince story about those frontier expeditions, and yeah. So I couldn't help thinking of that when I saw the line in the Bertolt Brecht poem about Caesar beating the Gauls. I wonder what they'll say about this over on Fox. No, damn it. Ancient Europeans were just white. They just were. Just got an email from Devin saying, Nordic Black Santa? Oh, golly Moses. Lots more for this Titanic Tuesday, and I will be happy to filibobster right merrily along if you want to jump in. I'll filibobster, or you can jump in. Our buddy the Angry Indian pointing out, in other words, he looked like an Aussie Aboriginal. And FYI, Angry says, the Sami people, indigenous to Sweden, Norway, Denmark, are, according to the Human Genome Project, genetically from North Africa. Also, the Basque have the oldest DNA and collective habitation in Europe as a group, to the point that they are virtually unrelated to other Europeans, perhaps except the Serbs, and Hungarians, of course, and Tatars. The original Saint Nick was a Turk, says the Catholic Church. But yeah, he was living in what was essentially well, the Anatolian Greek-speaking world. Luda with the question, being from southern Spain, couldn't he have possibly been mixed race, even been part North African? I'm sure race mixing isn't a new thing. No, the new thing is the idea of races to mix. That's the whole point. The concept of race as we understand it did not exist in the ancient world. One would refer to where someone was from geographically, or what one's locale was, but to talk of races, not so much. One talked of Gauls because Gauls were people who lived in Gaul. One talked of the Dacians because they were the people who lived in Dacia. But it was not understood as race. And who knows what kind of interbreeding took place within the human family over the years as humanity spread outward from Africa. I mean, but even the concept of interbreeding is a little bit fallacious because that makes it sound like there are different. I mean, there was apparently some interbreeding between Neanderthals and humans because we can still find the genetic material. But how do you interbreed inside the same species? And that's the pernicious effect of race or the concept of race. Sure didn't take old Morris long to figure out that he could interbreed with his slaves in the American South now, did it? No. There's just humans. At one point in time, the people who would go on to be humans, there was less than 2,000 of us in a little cluster in Africa. And then we began to fan out. Some, as Angry points out, becoming the Aboriginal people of Australia, the peoples of Papua New Guinea. I was watching a fascinating documentary on the history of India, just trying to fill in the gaps, you know, talking about a people whose memorized prayers are not in any known language, and they're down in the very southern tip of India. But that it's clearly language. It's just not a language anybody knows. And I guess some research was done, and the language is most closely related to the various noises made in birdsong. It may be among the first human attempts at language. We don't know. We're a fascinating little family. And we even now know, because I remember Dr. John pointing it out to me, we even now can fairly safely state that warfare is not endemic to the human condition. That it is a construct that exists as a result of, if I'm saying this right, tell me if I'm wrong, Dr. John, if you're out there, that it exists as a result of the institutions we build up around us. That's the thing. We are, and I understood what Kevin was saying earlier about sometimes you just got to tune out because there's just so much, there's so much stuff that's tough to stomach, but this isn't. This is kind of beautiful. Because we're self-aware enough to want to learn where we've been and maybe posit a little bit about where we're going. And we've made some really, really cockamamie mistakes along the way. The concept of race, the ideas of religion. Well, you know, state-level religion where you get to kill people who don't believe the right way or, you know, don't pray with the right headgear on or whatever. You get the idea. But it's absolutely captivating to contemplate. And the idea that somehow or another people have managed to say, oh, no, wait, they're definitely paler. We pale people. Yeah, we've got the inside track here. Please. Hey, white folks, go have a tomato. Get back to me. Yeah, you get my point, I think. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, you got me lit up tonight.
Hey, what's happening, Bill?
Well, let's go. Let's just start with combativeness of human nature. Was not Alexander the Great from a little state called Macedonia?
He was.
Which I believe isn't it part of Greece today or what?
Isn't it a standalone?
I don't believe so.
I don't know. My ignorance.
I worked with a guy who in a knitting shop who was Macedonian descendant. You talk about you can throw in all kind of Appalachian jokes into the standalone of that group as a in philosophy, but I don't know about actual geography there. That's got me whipped. But you've been on a hunt with me about so many things tonight. The things you guys keep hitting. I had a landlord at one point who had worked setting up a hospital in Saudi, so I heard a lot about that from him. Plus, his family came out of Breslau, which had been in part of Prussia, which it's now part of Poland. But that's where my maternal grandmother emigrated from in the early 1900s. She came from Breslau. Well, these things keep touching bases, you know. You're right on the money. What's going on with the crap in the river?
Oh, glad you asked. Thank you, Bill.
Well, in the world of comedy, I would have tried to. I could have been a good setup man.
I really am glad you asked because there was a new development today. Today, of course, I think I'm not for sure, but there was talk that water delivery would end. So this was sort of the you're on your own day. But secondary to that, there was a bit of a, and bear in mind, there was not accompanied by mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa, but there was a bit of a confession today. It turns out that the fine folks, and I mean that sarcastically, the fine folks at Freedom Industries, they sort of did a little bit more ciphering and figured out it was probably more like 10,000 gallons of poison that they dumped into the public drinking water supply of the Kanawha Valley.
Instead of
the 7,500 that had already been revised upward from 5,000 that had been revised upward from 4.
Then you could probably add more to it. Go ahead.
Right, and that's they don't know. The best they can figure out is that's how much that they had to sell that they didn't manage to sell. You know, I mean, capitalism comes in handy sometimes, and, you know, basic accounting.
Yeah, I caught a little from Desi and company from about the Exxon Valdez. They had to bring that up again. You know, I hadn't heard of that in years, of course.
Now, what was interesting, and maybe this will get some notice, Bill, and I'm not being a smartass about this, okay? I'm really not. There was a story in the newspaper today about a member of the West Virginia legislature, a member of the House of Delegates, who hails from an area that is not under attack by the coal industry. She hails from over in the Eastern Panhandle. And she has the additional distinction, and I'm not saying this from a sexist perspective, okay? I want to be really, really clear about that. She has the distinction of being a former Miss West Virginia. Okay, so she's got a little bit more of a bully pulpit, perhaps, than even your average member of the House of Delegates.
Yeah.
Okay, so she was
quicker, yes.
She was down here. The legislature is in session. And she was down here after the all clear was sounded, and of course it's a long way from Charlestown, West Virginia, to Charleston, West Virginia, and it's a little bit confusing into the bargain. But trust me when I say it's a long way. I mean, it can be a good 5-6 hour drive. Hard to believe in a state this small, but it's true. Anyway, so the all clear was sounded. She's down here for the legislative session. She's living in a hotel. And she jumps in the tub and takes a shower. Then her eye starts swelling. And the area around her eye becomes red and angry. And when and she tries to, you know, you don't just run to the doctor with everything. I mean, you know, hey, bathe in poison water. But it turned out she wound up having to go to her doctor when she was back home. He wound up having to cut, like a cut man in the corner in a boxing match, okay?
Yeah, makes sense.
To relieve the ocular pressure. And said that she had some sort of god-awful staph infection. So, and the way it works out, or the way it's surmised, is that the chemical irritated her. She rubbed her eye, had a little, you know, had some sort of bacteria on her finger, and boom. Hello.
Oh, yeah.
And so she stood up, apparently today or yesterday, in the House of Delegates and delivered an address on it and actually said, listen, maybe we need to be paying a lot of attention to this because we tend not to think about things that don't directly affect us. Hello?
Yeah.
I mean, can you, and she's, and this is shallow but not sexist, she is a lovely young woman, smart, articulate, and beautiful. So if you can imagine her with, you know, I don't know, looking like Rocky Balboa over in the corner having Burgess Meredith work on her, it would have somewhat of a profound effect. Am I saying this without being a total asshole? Because I'm really trying not to. I mean, I don't want to go down the road, you know, she's pretty. I don't want to do that.
It's very difficult to explain some of the, very difficult and hard to keep a straight face when you hear some of the crap you hear from the authorities. If it wasn't so tragic, you know, it's the old laugh or cry situation. What are you going to, how the hell do you, first you laugh and then you go after the problem. That's all my thinking about it, you know. Because if you go after a problem very angry, you can screw things up very quickly. Of course, it doesn't take much to screw these idiots, you know, because they're, with money's involved, don't contradict anything they say.
Yeah. And also, by way of, I guess, what you would call a buried lead out of the ongoing West Virginia water disaster story, it turns out that in addition to this pretty much being the end of water distribution, that, the Centers for Disease Control and the Department of Health and Human Resources have decided that they're no longer interested in gathering data on people who have gone to the hospital in the wake of the West Virginia water disaster.
They don't count for anything, Bob.
Yeah, well, nothing to see here. Move along. These are not the hillbillies you were looking for. You know, that kind of thing.
That's the old bullshit, yes. Who was the P.T. Barnum? Was he the one that said a fool is born every minute? Was that his?
That is alleged to have been, there's a sucker born every minute.
Yeah. Yeah. Entertainment still works on that, Bob.
Yeah, it does.
The only radio I have working in the bedroom is one where I'm forced to either listen to the overnight talk show or, which, you know, there's only so much bullshit you can sleep in. Or sports talk radio until I know more about the Super Bowl than I ever cared to know about it. Entertainment is...
Yeah, that's. I hate the fact that there's that two-week lull between the conference championships and the Super Bowl. Let's just play it the next week and get it over with.
Yeah, they got to give these sports talk shows some bulldozers and huge shovels.
2 weeks.
Yeah.
And I will probably draw the ire of... friends up in the greater New York City area. I hope it snows 2 feet on the Super Bowl.
What the hell are they thinking of? Because the old NFL, they would play in alternating cities. They played here in 64 in Cleveland, and I was 21 downtown watching the fights break out between Cleveland fans and Colt fans, and I just kind of stayed out of the way because...
Yeah, but I mean,
when it was necessary.
Right, but even when you, and you know, the Super Bowl comes to life as a result of the because the AFL was successful enough that it was beginning to scare the bejesus out of the NFL.
Yep.
So you get the merger, and you get old-time, you know, old-line NFL franchises like the Colts and the Steelers and the Browns getting shipped over to play in the AFC with the Jets and the Pats. Yep. And
to even things out.
Right, right. You had to. It couldn't just be NFL versus AFL anymore. I mean, I actually remember as a kid when we went from AFL to AFC. But you know, the Super Bowl is born out of that. That's why it has bowl. You know, they were just bogarting off the idea of vaguely holiday-era bowl games in the college circuit, right?
Yep.
So
they move those around so you don't know who's playing, you know?
Yeah. So you get the idea that we're going to play the Super Bowl in a neutral site, and that's how you wind up with Joe Namath laying on a chaise lounge by the pool in Miami, guaranteeing a victory over the Colts.
Yep.
You know, that was just an unfathomable, unconscionable heresy that, you know, the upstart AFL would beat, you know, a team of bruisers like the Baltimore Colts.
Yeah.
And then they did it. But it's Miami, it's New Orleans after the Super Bowl, the Dome gets built, Pasadena, the Rose Bowl, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, at least it was so,
but
it was
Jersey,
so warm as to be somewhat neutral as far as the cities go.
Yeah, Jersey in January?
Yeah. Well,
I'll get hate mail going, you know, what's wrong with it?
Go ahead.
I mean, they're going to play the Super Bowl in Detroit. Okay, there's a dome, isn't there?
In 1945, you have to go back and look it up, and the folks who are good with the Internet can look up the championship game between the Cleveland Rams of the NFL versus, I believe, the Washington, I can't remember who it was, the Washington Redskins. And the following year, the Rams were out in L.A. because some guy with the name Paul Brown was bringing a team in from into the new All-American Football Conference, which probably would have lasted if they had TV money. And, Paul had coached at Ohio State, and he coached, more importantly, at Great Lakes Naval Training Station. And he had guys passing through there during the war years who were people that he was able to grab a hold of, so to speak, and bring into the organization. That's why, plus he was a...
Yeah, I had forgotten that the Rams started in Cleveland and went to L.A.
Yeah, and now where are they? I don't know.
St. Louis.
Oh, they're in St. Louis, yeah. That was the St. Louis football Cardinals that came out of Chicago where there had been two teams, the Bears and the Chicago Cardinals, operating in the old days. Two teams in Chicago, huh?
Yeah.
There was one in Pittsburgh, one in Philly, one in Detroit, in the 1950s, Cleveland, Washington, and Baltimore, I think. They sent a team to Texas that failed, and that's what moved to Baltimore. It was a team in Texas in the early 50s. Yeah, there's a very good book called America's Game, which is a great history of professional football. I mean, it gives you more interest in the lowdown than you need to know.
Oh, by the way, Greg in the chat room is pointing out, Bill, he says, it's 75 here in San Diego, but the NFL won't come back here for the Super Bowl until the populace pays for a new stadium.
Yeah, well, they're bribing people. They did it here. They did it for baseball, football, and a big indoor joint where they have, of course, the Cavaliers, and then they have a minor league Colorado Rockies franchise, I think it is, playing here, the minor league. The Cleveland Barons were the top American. In the days of the 16 National League, I saw guys playing here. Well, one guy in particular who I'll name was a goaltender who started here, sold to New York, went around the American League, ended up in his old age, pushing 40, playing for the Cleveland Barons in the American Hockey League. And a buddy of his took over coaching the Maple Leafs. And this guy was called up, and he won two Stanley Cups and is in the Hall of Fame after spending most of his career in the minor leagues. A guy named Johnny Bauer. Ah, the brain is starting to turn over again. It's been slow after the near stroke. Because thank God for the.
No, everybody in the chat room is pointing out how sharp you sound and just how energetic and up and.
Oh yeah, because I kind of like where I'm living now. Although they're a pain, they haven't fixed my doorbell yet, so I can let anybody in. until I do that, I can't order a damn pizza, you know?
Right, because otherwise you just have to shoot through the door.
Well, this neighborhood, I owned a home up here, and I know it quite well. Streets changed. Coventry's changed. A buddy of mine had a big TV shop where I'd hang out, and if he needed an extra pair of hands, I'd get the voltmeter out and make a buck or two here and there. Things have been pretty damn good. I've been all around the two counties, Cuyahoga and the lake. And, I'm getting scared now when I go to sleep at night. I figure, well, tomorrow may never come. Because that incident really kicked me in the ass. So I had a heart attack at 51. It didn't scare me that bad. Because your whole attitude at 51 is different than it is at 71. You know, 71, it's like, oh, well. But that's why I have to tune in here and stick this old crap in people's faces, because it's... I have a friend who's a very good history teacher who I believe talked to you when I was in the hospital.
Yeah, we did talk.
He's a great guy. And he's spent 40-some years teaching, and he bends far to the left. And he's got a kid who's an excellent guitar player. But to make a long story short, we met in a bar. He's talking to me. He said, "Where the hell did you learn all this stuff?" Because he has the degrees that I don't have. You know, that was my problem, Bob. I hated school. I lived in a very miserable neighborhood. Go get a job in a knitting factory for a buck an hour in '59. You know.
But that was America, though. There was factory work to be had.
Yes, there was all kinds. I used to peddle milk from house to house. That was a strange, funny job, because every single woman I had for a customer seemed to have friends that she wanted me to meet them. Oh, God, it was like a damn TV show and that kind of shit. But, yeah, you are the one thing, Halberstam's book on Korea, he gives two chapters to Chiang Kai-shek and his relationship with the States. We poured so much money into those nationalist armies. And these guys were surrendering to Mao and handing over all the weapons. And, of course, in 1950, our own people got a nice taste of those weapons. Because all Mao could see was an American army of, that's when Hearst, who was the guy that ran Time magazine?
Luce?
You Luce. You know, his family, what they did when he was a kid? How about Chinese missionaries of a Protestant faith? In fact, when he was going to college...
That was a growth industry at one point in time. Her birthplace is here in West Virginia, but Pearl Buck spent the majority of her childhood and much of her adulthood in China. Because her parents were missionaries.
Halberstam quotes a conversation between Pearl Buck and himself. And he was roughshod calling the shots. And again... The villains of the piece were like the Republican congressman Jenner and name after name of right-wing Republican congressmen who were... I heard a Truman speech today that one of our daytime talk show hosts, the guy, the gentleman that wears sandals, highly educated young man. He's not young. He's probably in his 60s. He comes out of Chicago every day in the afternoon. And why can't I think of it? Well, that's what I said about my memory. You know, shit that I used to be able to spit out of my mouth is getting stuck somewhere in my false teeth. This book lays it. I mean, I knew guys at one time. I knew two guys that were old enough to have flown from India to China over the hump, over the Himalayas or Himalayas?
You say tomato and I say tomato. Let's call the whole thing off.
And they had attitudes about risking their necks to bring in tons of supplies and money. And, you know, Mrs. Shek, Madame, her brothers were big shots in the money markets. And Chiang Kai-shek never did control the whole country. By way of comparison,
Imelda Marcos, who would rise to a certain amount of infamy later for her...
the Marcos family...
For her excesses. She was a piker compared to Madame Chiang, wasn't she?
Oh, absolutely.
Rank amateur.
There was a thing called Terry and the Pirates, this comic strip, and they had this thing called the Dragon Lady. Of course, you know, very Asian you know, prejudiced. And she was roughly based on, Roosevelt sent a guy over there to talk to him, some businessman, and he called him Mr. Sheck. Yeah, it's like, okay, people are, but he made a, what's his name, was playing a Truman speech, and, you know, Truman tried to push health care post-war. And got nowhere with it with the Republicans.
Oh, right, yeah. That was the do-nothing...
The do-nothing Congress that was, what, 46 elected, the two-year span there? And then they came in 48, they were pretty hard hit. Because I still don't know how Truman won that election. You know, because who was it, Strom Thurmond ran from the Dixie Cream?
Yeah, he ran on the swimming pool platform.
Yeah, and the other guy that ran against Truman was Henry Wallace, who was much farther.
Yeah, who ran from the left.
And Dewey, he must have been the biggest loser in history. But I think Truman has a picture from the Chicago Tribune, which was very pro-Republican.
Oh, the Dewey defeats Truman photo?
Yeah, I love that. That's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Because it was actually printed. It was actually on a press run, an early press run. But I won't tie you up anymore, but, you know, you got me cranked as usual, Bob. You can hit certain areas. Like the young man who called from Saudi, I happened to, as I say, when my landlord helped build a hospital there, so I had got a lot of stories in the early 70s about living there and, you know, how you dealt with things. And hell, I was at Cleveland Clinic one time, and one of the most beautiful women I've seen in years came in, and she was a doctor from that part of the world. Well, I'm trying to remember whether she was Saudi or what, but she was so stunning, I had to grab my heart, you know? This woman was so gorgeous, I said, oh, God. And a buddy, I'll leave you with one more story. A friend of mine takes her autistic grandkid out for Halloween, and I would sit on the porch handing out candy, and it's a mixed, a lot of Arabs in the neighborhood, and it's so gratifying to see these men bringing their wives and kids around and picking up free candy and smiling at you and shaking hands with you, and because that kind of stuff, whether it's real or not, it sure makes you feel better. When another man shakes my hand with my right hand and doesn't have his left hand in my pocket, first of all, I know he's not a politician, so.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'll let you go with that.
Well, Bill, have yourself a very good evening. And
well, as I sit here and listen to the rest of the show. Thank you.
All right. You take care. We'll talk soon. Our buddy Bill, Mr. Stress, sounding better than he ever has, calling from Cleveland. Just got notification of this. It's from ABC News. Dated today, and it's actually from the Associated Press, Michael Biesecker, the reporter. Police in a North Carolina town are searching for a man who sprayed a church playground with gunfire, striking four youths and leaving a 12-year-old boy gravely wounded. The Reverend James Galliard at Word Tabernacle Church in Rocky Mount said the shooting happened shortly before 6 p.m. Monday as about two dozen neighborhood teens played basketball on courts behind the church. Galliard was in his office when he heard more than 15 gunshots and ran outside. Among those hit was 12-year-old Narik Horn, who the preacher said was shot in the head. He cradled the bleeding boy until help arrived. In our community, we do hear gunshots from time to time, but what was different this time was that it was so close, and it was so many. I held him in my arms until the paramedics got there. He was shot in the eye, and the bullet went out the back of his brain. He was struggling to breathe, but he was fighting. Police said Tuesday that Horn remained in critical condition. Three other young males shot. Young males. Why is it young males? Why isn't it young men? That's just a style manual thing. I'm not maybe a perfectly, but young males could be anything, couldn't they? Young men means young humans. Just saying. Three other young males shot, age 13, 17, and 19, were all treated and released. Witnesses could provide only a vague description of the shooter, who ran away and was seen getting into a small, light-colored SUV. Rocky Mount Police are asking members of the public to come forward with any information that might help lead them to a suspect. It was the latest shooting in a small southern city dealing with violent crime on a scale typical in more urban areas. Oh, dear. My goodness, we are pulling some freight with this language, aren't we? The shooting at the church happened days after a funeral for 15-year-old Brian Freeman, who was walking home with a friend when a car pulled up and someone started firing. A city of 60,000 located about 50 miles east of Raleigh, Rocky Mount sits along Interstate 95, a primary north-south corridor for moving drugs and illegal guns between major East Coast cities. Anybody want to explain the relevance of this part to me, please? I mean, is there anything about young men sitting around doing drugs while playing? No. In 2012, the most recent year for which the FBI crime statistics are available, the homicide rate in Rocky Mount was more than twice that of New York City. What they are dancing around here is the fact that this was apparently a group of African-American young males, and that's why they're called young males and not called young men. 150 years later, and we're... Oh, well. The Rocky Mount Police Force has a robust gang awareness and prevention program. One can only wonder at what the meaning of robust is in that context. The city council has instituted anti-graffiti measures and a local youth protection ordinance that includes a nightly curfew barring those under 15 from gathering in public places without adult supervision. Wonder why that is. Maybe it's because other adults are prone to shooting that... Oh, well. Lewis said it is too early in the investigation to know whether the latest shooting involved a gang-related dispute, but Galliard said there is a widespread suspicion in the community that Monday's shooting was in retaliation for the recent drive-by killing. Those involved are from different neighborhoods engaged in competition for turf, the preacher said. Galliard moved south from Philadelphia 9 years ago to start the church. Part of his congregation's ministry involves reaching out to young people who live nearby. Galliard said he had never seen Horn before he was shot, but he has since met the boy's family at the hospital. Notice he's gone from being a male to boy. He organized a vigil on Tuesday to pray for the boy's recovery and an end to the violence. He said people there are often distrustful of the police, but he was encouraging people to tell the detectives what they know. Unfortunately, in my time here, I have funeralized a lot of young African-American males. This is the last paragraph of this piece, and it's the first time we see the word African, phrase African-American. I have funeralized a lot of young African-American males who died in violent situations, the preacher said. We put the basketball goals up and took the fence down specifically so the community could just walk on the premises and have a safe place to play. That trust has been violated. Wonder where somebody would get the gun with which to commit such a heinous act. Well, they're easily obtained in the state of North Carolina, Stan, for the first place, and secondly, it turns out that whole bunches and more than 100,000 guns are stolen every year in the United States, you know, from the lawful gun owners. I think I saw, yeah, it was Lieutenant Colonel Robert Bateman writing over at the Esquire blog, politics blog, pointed that out. That's how so many legal firearms get into the illegal stream of commerce. But we're okay. We're okay with it. I mean, there's a lot of hurt and grieving people. Three dead people in Columbia, Maryland on Saturday. Two more dead folks in West Virginia on Sunday. These shot up young human beings on Monday, but Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, somebody gets, absolutely. And see, that's the thing. Somebody doesn't get shot every day in some other places in the world. Somebody does not get shot every day in Australia. Somebody does not get shot every day of the week, every day of the year in Japan. Is there a shooting every day of the week in South Korea? How about the UK? France, Germany, Italy, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Denmark, the Netherlands, Austria, Switzerland, where everybody has to have a gun, you know, because they're part of the well-regulated militia? Nope, somebody doesn't get shot every day. Where have all the flowers gone? Indeed. By the way, Michael pointed out with regard to that phrase, where have all the flowers gone? That's engraved on Marlene Dietrich's memorial plaque in Berlin. Wow. I'm informed by the right-wingers who send me these unsolicited PR pitches that Americans for Prosperity, you know, the tea baggers, they done bought themselves some advertising time. This year is a story of Emily. And she's going to the State of the Union as the guest of representing Marsha Blackburn.
Goodness!
Remember Marsha?
Goodness!
Marsha.
Goodness!
Americans for Prosperity tells us that the new ad shares the experience of Emily, a woman suffering from a chronic illness who had her plan canceled due to Obamacare and has had to take on a second job just to pay for the more expensive plan she is forced to buy. Emily's story begins airing this week on national cable outlets. Previewing Obama's State of the Union speech, AFP President Tim Phillips said, "Tonight, President Obama will attempt to change the subject away from the millions of Americans who have been hurt by his greatest achievement and signature health care law. People like Emily have been hurt by Obamacare. They've had their plans canceled, costs skyrocket, and in many cases lost access to their doctor. The American people deserve better than more broken promises." Emily's 39 years old, and she is a lupus sufferer. She said she had a plan that was stellar and affordable. That plan's been canceled. Oddly enough, not by the federal government, but by the insurance company. And she's disappointed, Emily is, that President Obama broke his promise. The result of Obamacare is that people like Emily are getting hurt, according to Americans for Prosperity. I'm making an assumption here that she is from Tennessee, because she is the guest of
goodness,
Marsha Blackburn. Couple of observations here. She's a CPA, Emily is, and she cares for her mama. Well, I'm glad she cares for her mama. Lots of us care for our mamas. Mamas who are no longer with us, even. We still care for them. Oh, that's not what they mean. Okay. Emily needs to quit palling around with the terrorists of AFP and get out of her seat, onto her feet, and into the street and advocate for universal single-payer health care. for which she would qualify as a Merkin. Even a Merkin for prosperity. These poor yammering idiots at AFP, they never cease to amaze. Oh, a little follow-up to the North Carolina story coming from Ron in Raleigh, who brings a special expertise, being as how he is Ron in Raleigh. Hey, Bob, remember, Governor McCrony signed a law making it illegal to destroy confiscated weapons or weapons that have been turned in. Right, because, you know, guns are more important than 13, 15, and 16-year-old males. Ron and Raleigh points out, you know, they could have bought the gun used in the shooting at the Dixie Classic. They could have bought the gun used in the shooting at the Dixie Classic Gun and Knife Show here in Raleigh. Yeah, they could have. I remember when that one lawful gun owner shot up the Pentagon or the metro station at the Pentagon. He used a weapon that had been confiscated in Memphis and was forbidden to be destroyed, and instead had to be turned out into the stream of holy commerce. I bet you remember that, too. Hey, thanks very much, Sal. Sal is always there most every evening, and much appreciated that you are, Sal, because you are the only person who has responded this evening to our ongoing fundraising needs, and Sal needs some company. If you'd care to go to the PayPal button, you are more than welcome to do so, or use the traditional mail address. Just shoot me a note and say, "Hey Bob, it's on the way," and I'll tell Boss Man Wayne that he doesn't have to wear his anti-spider bite gloves when he goes to reach into the mailbox. Robin Raleigh also pointing out, "Hey, remember the beginning of the program? I said who's going to yell, Negro, you lie?" Well, now we know. It'll most likely be Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee Stan who will yell, "Goodness!" either before or after she says it. Wowzer. Got a couple here that I'm trying to figure out whether or not I need to hang on to for prayer meeting Wednesday, and I'm kind of inclined to do that. But by the way, speaking of guns out there in the stream of commerce, and the folks who want to use them, and the manner in which they hope to use them. And speaking of teabaggers, I mean, sorry, but we were. Americans for prosperity. Because it says right there in the Constitution that Jesus wants us to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Sure it does. So, over there at Radio TV Rwanda, they hired a retired major general by the name of Paul Vallely to be a military analyst for them. And he's gotten to go around the country giving teabagging speeches. And he wanted folks to know, that he's ready to do his patriotic duty in Merca. This is a retired major general. Not kidding.
We've got a lot of veterans organizations. We've got 200,000 Marines that they're tying me into. I had a call this afternoon from Idaho. The gentleman said, "If I give you 250,000 Marines to go to Washington, will you leave them?" I said, yes.
Oh, my God. Listen to the faithful in Surprise, Arizona. No, really, that's where this was delivered. Listen to the faithful in Surprise, Arizona laugh. I'm not sure what they're laughing at, the idea of people being mowed down or left to gutter out their last breaths while their blood seeps out onto the ground, or just exactly which funny part they're laughing at, but they are, sure as God made little green apples laughing.
I will, Hunter. If I give you 250,000 Marines to go to Washington, will you lead them? I said, yes, I will. I'll surround the White House, and I'll surround the Capitol building. But it's going to take physical presence to do that. Writing letters to these senators and congressmen, I am so frustrated because nothing happens. So I think I'm not inciting a revolution, but we've got to get more physical and stand up and protest. And the great things that the Tea Party did, I mean, they were out there in community standing up being seen. They did things. So we've got to go based on what the Tea Party has done and elevate it into something and get
elevate.
More younger people involved. So I don't know how else to do it.
You got that? He doesn't know how else to do it, but he just said he would be willing to lead 250,000 Marines to surround the White House and the Capitol of the United States. Now, again, it was a long time ago, the last political science class that I took, but the last I checked, that's called a, come on, somebody, anybody, help here. That's a, that's a coup d'etat. Yeah, in case you were wondering, the right wing is out there talking treason some more. That's what this is. This is treason talk. I don't know of another way to do it, he says.
And I don't want to be criticized for starting a revolution.
Except you just said you wanted to.
But I'd certainly head it if we had to.
I don't think we've heard such a bold statement of bravery since who was it that came out and said, I'm in charge here? Wasn't that after Ronnie Reagan was shot? Oh, it wasn't George Shultz. Oh, who was the crazy old bastard? I'm in charge here. Luckily, I've forgotten. Okay. Wait.
And I don't want to be criticized for starting a revolution, but I'd certainly head it if we had to. We all love a good fight if it's worth it, right?
You got that? Did you hear them clapping and laughing, them teabaggers, about the idea of blood-soaked revolution? We all love a good fight if it's worth it, right? I guess it's that point where you sit down to have a conversation about what worth it means. Okay, this from Kate. Subject line, institutional racism, sexism. Bob, I was going to let this one go, but I can't help compare this story, dead babies in North Carolina, well, wounded ones, critically injured ones, and yes, previously some dead ones, yes, and the most recent event is, dead babies in North Carolina to the past Ms. West Virginia's shower. How is it that her plea for attention to the polluted river has creds? The public will pay attention to her plight and infection because she's purdy. The news reports get away with the racist crap in news in North Carolina because all the hell with it. What's the use? I can't wait for the speech. I'll have my head wrapped in a good audiobook while eating on my latest batch of split pea soup with ham hocks. Sounds like a pretty good approach in my book. Look, I'm the guy who said during the Kingston coal ash disaster, maybe if we could send an oil-soaked dolphin bobbing down the Tennessee River, maybe more people in the country would pay attention to it. And that's the whole point. Not yelling at you, Kate.
You got 300,000 people whose water supply was poisoned. But, you know, she stood up on the floor of the House to talk about it because it actually happened to her. And she said, we tend to forget things really matter until they happen to us. And at this point in time, I'm just kind of desperate for somebody to keep paying attention to this story. I had a tweet from an individual who said, Erin Brockovich is on the case. Saw her on Bill Maher Friday. It's not over, but the media, they're complicit in ignorance. And I got a little bit of a tough time with that. Erin Brockovich is not going to save anybody. I mean, I know she's a celebrity, and I don't dislike her, and I'm not trying to show disrespect for her. But the legal system is a system that is designed to deal with horses who are already with barn doors that are being closed after the horses are already gone. Not that I'm comparing people to horses. I'm not. It's metaphor. And frankly, the question is wide open because, see, we've already got experience with this in the Mountaintop Removal Sacrifice Zone. What do you do when the cancer clusters start popping up? Because, you know, they've been doing this, they've been doing mountaintop removal and prepping coal and whatnot around in these communities for 10, 15 years. And pumping this filth into the ground and into sludge dams and what have you and blowing dust into the air. And you know what happens? Somebody dies of lung cancer. They go, well, didn't he smoke for about 15, 20 years? Yeah, smoking got him. And that's exactly what these corporate killers live for. 5 years, 10 years from now, when a baby that was bathed in this poisonous filth has a terrified mama or a terrified daddy or both sitting in the doctor's office as the doctor explains childhood leukemia to them. Well, you reckon it was the water? Ah, it could have been anything. And all that any lawyer can do is perhaps get some sort of compensation during the course of litigation that could take 5 years, 10 years, to help pay for the coverage and the cost of treating the child that they need right now. This is a question about it's about what's going on right now, but it's also transitioning into a question. It's not even transitioning. This is what the question has been all along. How do you stop the next one? How do you make sure the next one doesn't happen? And I have no confidence whatsoever that anybody in the state house in Charleston, West Virginia, or God knows the governor's mansion, or in the corporate office buildings that control both, are even remotely likely to attempt to stop the next one. Because we've got a history of not stopping the next one. Because the poisoning of the water supply of 300,000 people was the next one. Until the next one. In 1972, the Buffalo Creek disaster that killed 125 people was the next one. But the teabaggers want to surround the Capitol with 250,000 Marines because that one is in our White House. Thank you, Michael. It was Al Haig. I'm in charge here. Thank you. Ron and Raleigh with a question. Please tell me. Bob, could you tell me what these crazy sons of bitches want? More freedom, more guns, less taxes, what? All of the above. And they'd like for us to just shut up and give them their way. Remember, they want Haiti with cable. They want Somalia with internet.
and a perpetual soundtrack sung by Lee Effin Greenwood. Because remember, that God Bless the USA thing has a sort of an apocalyptic quality to it. You know, if tomorrow all the things I had and worked for all my life and I was left with nothing but my children and my life, yada, 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 thank God, God bless the USA. Yeah. The next one. Thank you very much, Diane. Diane decided to provide a little company to Sal, and we are now only $200 away from meeting tonight's fundraising goal. If we don't meet it, then tomorrow's fundraising goal will be $350, and that's not a goal, that's a hole, and it's kind of, I guess it's kind of fitting that a program that originates in mining country would spend time in a hole. But believe me, I understand. It's hard times. Hard times. Let's go to the phones. 304-658-3333 if you want to get involved in the conversation. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob. How you doing?
Evening, Jim.
Well, it's been quite an interesting program. You certainly covered the whole spectrum there.
Well, I wanted to start out with something at least moderately inspiring, you know.
Yeah, I guess so. But a couple things here in reference to that flag officer who offered his services, so to speak. It sort of reminds me of that film 7 Days in May, where Burt Lancaster played Mattoon.
Yep.
And of course, Kirk Douglas, as his chief of staff, had to warn the president of what was happening. And it's sort of like a 7 Days in May type of situation with him.
Well, you know, there's even an aspect of foregone reality to it, Jim. Back in the 1930s, after the election of Franklin Roosevelt, the Bush family, along with some of the other prominent wealth families in this country, tried to hire two-time Medal of Honor, Congressional Medal of Honor winner Smedley Butler to lead a coup against Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he declined.
Well, he best be glad he did, because he would have been shot out of hand.
Well, he was a patriot. He wouldn't have any part of it.
Well, I mean, you know,
this is the man who wrote War is a Racket.
I mean, you know, as far as this particular man is concerned, and any person who's ever raised his right hand, that's an oath for life. It's just not an oath while you're in service that you will protect and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Didn't realize it was a lifer.
Of course it is. Anybody to whom it means anything. You know, what is the taking of an oath? Think about it.
Yeah. It's not time limited.
You pour it out in your hands, and you just either cup your hands and hold it, or you just open them and let it pour out like water.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, pursuant to, let's see, something else you were talking about. Oh, I thought you'd like to know that the sheriff of Raleigh County was on television and made a statement that because of the incidents of people having so many weapons here in West Virginia, that the likelihood of any type of shooting or whatever would be much less because people are so well armed.
Right. That's why those two guys are dead down in,
I thought to myself, how ironic that a person in public office would say something like that.
He must be up for re-election this year.
I don't know who the guy is, but like I say, I try to keep myself like hermetically sealed from people like this. Good Lord in heaven, it's just incredible.
Yeah, because guns bring peace.
No, they don't.
No,
they don't bring peace at all. They bring the exact opposite of peace. But let's see, what else did I want to surface here? Well, I thought that was one of the more remarkable things that I heard today. And then, of course, you last night I was talking to a friend of mine who is pledged to Fox News and this, that, and the other, and her remarks to me was, did you hear that President Obama is supporting marijuana?
Oh, dear God.
And I said, where did you hear this? And she said, well, I just don't want to say because I know it's going to get you all upset. And I said, don't want to get me all upset. I said, when I finish with you, you're going to be the one who's all upset. So tell me where you heard it. Well, you know that most of my people watch Fox News. And I said, right. I said, the greatest instrument of public detriment is Pravda. Or, in Hitler's day, the Volkische Beobachter. Edited by Joseph Goebbels. And I said, that's exactly what it is. I said, what the president said was that marijuana would be less harmful than alcohol. And yet that was construed by all these people who listen to this crap, and that's the only channel they watch. And there are so many people who get all this news and stuff like that by hearsay, who don't even hear the stuff. But, of course, by the time that the third or fourth person hears it, it's become so amplified and transmogrified that it doesn't even resemble the idiocy that comes out of Fox News.
No, it's like the little children's game of telephone where you sit in a circle and you start with one thing and it comes back around the circle completely different.
Exactly. I mean, you know, he just passed word of mouth and they accept this stuff as gospel.
Yeah.
And
you know who said that? Because I saw a clip about it. Rush Limbaugh said, Barack Obama's plan is to have every teenager smoking the marijuana.
Oh, that's something else we got into last night. I said, is this from Rush Limbaugh? I said, he's wanted to really condemn anybody about illegal drug use. Well, I didn't know about that. I said, well, let me fill you in about some things about Rush Limbaugh and OxyContin and some trips to the Dominican Republic and stuff like that. I said, you want to hear more?
I mean, you know, him talking, isn't there just a sort of almost unspeakable high level of irony involved in Flush Limbaugh inveighing and fulminating against cannabis? I mean, in light of the whole, I mean, how many thousands of dollars was it? Was it $30,000 he sent out with his maid in a cigar box to bring back a cigar box full of street drugs?
That was a whole bunch.
I mean, it was some serious Jed Clampett walking around money. I don't remember the exact amount, but yeah.
It was a lot of money. And, you know, it was a big stink over, and then it just went away. Nobody ever remembers it.
You know why it went away, of course.
Well, it's because they wanted it to go away.
No, because the American Civil Liberties Union jumped to his defense.
Well.
And oddly enough, he has not had much to say. He used to rail against the liberal American Civil Liberties Union. And he hasn't had so much to say about it ever since they pulled his fat literally out of the fire.
Well, I can see good things about that and bad things about that. I think he should have been taken right to the wall, to tell you the truth.
Well, there was a guy doing life at the same time in the Florida prison system.
Exactly.
Who was busted for doctor shopping.
Exactly.
I think he's probably still there.
I'm sure he is. I mean, he's doing hard time if he's in Florida. That's for damn sure. You can make sure that those people are not going to make his stay any bed of roses. But nonetheless, you know, it's just hard to deal with people like that. You know what I'm saying? And
yeah.
And the people who just accept it and take it as gospel. And this particular lady is a devout Roman Catholic, and I said, you know, the same type of population with whom you associate, in many cases, are the ones who condemn you and your religion and say terrible things about the Pope, call him a Roman dictator, and your faith and your religion. And I said, they think that you are belonging to an idol-worshipping bunch of heathens, and yet these are the people with whom you comport. Needless to say, the conversation ended after that.
Well, I can imagine, but
I mean, it really did. It was just, I mean, it was...
Click.
Just, right. And, you know, this lady's just not stupid. I mean, she's been all over the world serving with the government.
No.
I'm listening to me. Served in Ecuador. Served in Vietnam, two tours as a civilian. Was in Berlin, Germany, as a civil service employee. And I just told her, I said, I cannot believe a person that has your background and your travel and your experience would be so susceptible to this balderdash as you have explained to me tonight. And I said, I'm totally gap-spot. Or whatever the term is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's totally, you know, it really made me angry. And I said, look, if we and I are to have any more conversations, do not bring up anything political to me. Because if you do, and if you cite that idiocy on Fox News, I said, it's going to bring back, it will be a terrible provocation for which you will be unprepared. I mean, it's getting to the point where people can't even talk to people anymore.
It's been that way for a while, but it does, every time it seems like it's gotten as bad as it can be, somebody finds a way to make it worse.
Yeah, last night exactly was just an example. And then was mentioned to me something in a previous conversation about people were going to come get her and put her in some type of relocation center.
Oh, the FEMA, Obama FEMA reeducation camps.
I said, where'd you hear that?
Do you think she's not just maybe playing with your head?
No, she's not. No, she's not. Because the trouble is, when I finish with her, she's just at the point of tears. And I said, are you hearing this in church? Are you hearing it? Where are you hearing this? And at one point, to stop some of this stuff, I said, I know you're a priest, and I'll be glad to give him a call and just ask him what the hell he's telling you during his sermon.
Well, you know, I mean, they do preach that stuff from the pulpit. And no religion is immune from it, Jim.
Unfortunately, you're right. And I said, these people are just, you know, banefully ignorant, and they simply will listen to anything that comes over TV. They think that's the truth, and, you know, it's just amazing how Fox and...
Yeah, and you know where all... Rob in Minnesota just pointed this out to me. You know where all this Sturm und Drang comes from? One simple statement by Barack Obama. All he said was, I don't think it, meaning cannabis, is more dangerous than alcohol.
That's exactly what he said. And I hit her with that. Oh, is that what he said?
I mean, is there anybody who does? I mean, who doesn't, like, live under a bell jar in Ripley's Believe It or Not auditorium?
I don't know, Bob. Tell you the truth, I wonder.
I mean, I used to... I've had cops tell me. You know, cops. That alcohol is by far more dangerous.
And she said, well, why are they so up against marijuana and stuff like this? I said, number one, I said the DEA is certainly not going to do anything that will eliminate their funding because of the failing war that they're fighting against it. I said the cartels in Mexico and Latin America and the people who grow this stuff, they don't want to see that attitude go away, because if it were legalized, it would put them out of business, just like when they repealed prohibition. It put the bootleggers out of business. And I said, when you decriminalize something, it makes the whole profit motive go, you know, away compared to what it was. Well, I guess that's right. Prohibition wasn't exactly right, was it? I said, no, it wasn't. I said, it gave the mafia all of its walking around money. that lasted through the 50s and 60s and 70s. I said, how, that's how they really got big with all.
You know, this, I mean, this would not shock me in the least, Jim, were it not for the fact that you prefaced it by saying that this person has traveled internationally working as a civil servant for the government and has been exposed to, I mean, gee whiz.
I just asked her, I said, during your travels, I said, where was your head? Inside of a bell jar? That was the term that I used.
Great minds, Jim, great minds.
I did. Well, no, I mean, you know, and of course the highest level this particular person achieved was a GS-6. And I just told her flat out, I said, you know, you've asked me why you didn't ascend any higher into the ranks of the civil service. You've just explained it to me. Now, think about what you just said. But nonetheless, you know, people like that are, well, I have to, the reply was, well, you know, that's interesting. I'll have to go think about that.
Don't go think about it. Go learn it. Go learn the facts.
Oh, it's just crazy. But nonetheless, that's basically what I have to say. Oh, I did enjoy your tribute to Pete Seeger by using the Melania Dietrich song. That was just
I just ran across that earlier today, and I was just really taken with it.
Well, she did a lot of wonderful things. Let me tell you something. That lady, in addition to being a wonderful actress, was also an incredibly good entertainer. My first exposure to her was with an album my father had called OSS, and it showed her sitting in a pair of fatigues with a baseball cap pulled over to the right side of her head, and that's when she was singing for our troops, Lily Marlene and other songs of that nature. And I don't think any couturier could have presented a more beautiful creature in that outfit on the cover of that album than it was Marlene Dietrich sitting there smoking a cigarette on the wreckage of a German plane.
It's a hell of an image.
It is. And
Ferg, you'll get a kick out of this. Ferg and I sat one night because every now and then I try to just make him watch a movie that's in black and white to remind him that, you know, not all, that, you know, doesn't have to be in color to be good. And so we watched the classic Charles Laughton, Marlena Dietrich.
Witness for the prosecution.
Witness for the prosecution.
Oh, boy. With Tyrone Power.
Yeah, with Tyrone Power.
Oh, God.
And now Ferg.
And Elsa Lanchester was in that, too.
Yes, she was. You're absolutely right.
As as Charles Laughton's
nurse.
Nurse, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, just delightful and brilliant all the way around. But that one moment when Marlena Dietrich lets Charles Laughton in on the Dodge, mm-hmm. and looks at him and says, "Hey, ducky."
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, for some reason or another, because Ferg never saw it coming. I don't think he'd ever seen a really, really piece of complex, you know, mystery writing. Which, when it's good, is really, really good. And when it's bad, it's still pretty good. It's kind of like pizza that way. And sex.
Listen, that was a keeper, definitely.
Oh, it was. And so he was absolutely knocked sideways by the way that film ended.
Uh-huh.
And I know that it made an impression on him because things, you know, I think it's just the way our brains work around here. You know, little phrases stick here and there and become part of the patois of family conversation. And we were somewhere doing something the other day, and all of a sudden he looks at me and goes, "Hey, ducky." And it was kind of gratifying, Jim, because it meant that that had stuck. You know, that meant the whole film had stuck, because I stopped and I said, "Where'd that come from?" He said, "Witness for the prosecution. How could I ever forget?"
Well, I mean, you've achieved the highest level of education in that synthesis, because he's now repeating it. And now I'm sure in his own mind, we'll never forget it. And is repeating it back to you. I mean, that movie was extremely instructive to him.
Oh, and in the chat room, Stockton Larry just pointed out another good another good blah and white film. Remember when Rick Santorum said he said blah people, not black people? That's another one of those phrases that's entered the lexicon alongside Morian. Another good blah and white film is Orson Welles' Touch of Evil, and it absolutely is. With the is it the Ferris wheel in Vienna? That scene.
Now, you thinking about The Third Man, or you...
Oh, I'm thinking about The Third Man. Touch of Evil is...
Mexico.
Mexico, right. Yeah, because it's got, the longest single shot, the very beginning of it. It's the longest single dolly shot or something in history.
Yeah, that's it right there. But, you know, it's incredible. These greats of the screen have passed on, they've passed over, and I wonder if they'll ever be replaced again. And giving... tribute to Marlene Dietrich in one other film, and that's The Judgment at Nuremberg. Who could have played that role any better?
Oh, no one. No one.
It's Frau Berchtold. And, you know, basically her conversations with Spencer Tracy, the advocate on the tribunal. But the judge on the tribunal. And Richard Widmark and... oh, God, it was just incredible. That movie never ceases to amaze me. And the reason is because I stood right there on that field, on Zeppelin Field, that they showed.
Yeah.
And even gotten up to the point of standing exactly where Hitler stood on the dais or the projected balcony.
Yeah, the rostrum or... Yeah.
Exactly. And I thought to myself, you know, can you imagine what happened here 30-some-odd years ago?
That'd still be pretty... Well, and that's kind of what I was talking about, Jim, with her rendition of Where Have All the Flowers Gone. That had a profound meaning for a Europe that was still rising from its own ashes.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, she did other things, like Puff the Magic Dragon. You should listen to that. That's a good one. And remember... several Christmases ago when I asked you to play her Little Drummer Boy.
Yeah, her Little Drummer Boy, right.
So she had quite a life and was the daughter of a Prussian policeman and happened to hook up with the right director who got her into Hollywood. But I tell you one thing, the Nazis did everything they could to bring her back to Germany before the war. She would not go.
And she and Ernest Hemingway had a long friendship.
She had lots of friendships with a lot of people. She lived a very full life, and there was a documentary done about her life by Maximilian Schell, who is, of course, played the Herr Rolf in A Judgment at Nuremberg, Burt Lancaster's advocate. But he did a documentary about her. But you never saw her. She was living in Paris at the time. And I think was confined basically to her home. But nonetheless, it was very interesting. And, you know, people go through various parts of their lives in which they are extremely productive, as she was. And then, of course, you know, it has to come to an end sometime, someplace, somewhere, sometime. But they certainly made a definite contribution to film and to anyone who has the sense enough to watch their performances in their movies, whether it's A Witness for the Prosecution or whether it's The Judgment at Nuremberg or whether it's Orson Welles and some of the stuff he did. I'm just so glad we have that to rely upon. Because I can guarantee you one thing, after some of the stuff that I've seen coming out of Hollywood this time and, you know, in this day and time, I guess I'm being old-fashioned here, and I'll be...
No, there's some good stuff out there, but it seems like you've got to sort through a lot of dross to get to the pure ore.
I would think so. Absolutely.
Well, Jim, have yourself a good evening.
Well, I hope you're warm enough. It's like 10.5 here.
It's taken me all day, but I've got it up to 70 degrees in here.
Really?
Yeah, it will not stay that way for very long once this gas bottle runs out and the program's over.
Are you having any trouble getting propane?
No.
Well, I'm glad you don't, because I know there's an acute shortage of it.
They say it's over in a shortage over in Ohio and Indiana, but these little space heaters just run on those little 1-pound bottles, and I ration themselves out to myself very, very carefully.
Well, the best of luck to you in using that. You know, I hope you have an open window and everything.
Oh, like it's got a built-in carbon monoxide sensor and everything. So,
okay, all right. Well, listen, have a good evening.
I just wanted to run
those things by you, and thank you again for using that song.
Well, have yourself a good evening, Jim, and stay warm.
I'll try.
We're not out of the woods yet, but
no, it's supposed to be kind of rough tomorrow too.
And I guess come Friday, rain and a high of like 48 or something.
Let's hope it'll, well, you know, it'll come and go. But let's hope that'll offer a little relief.
Yeah, indeed.
Good night, sir.
Take care. Bye now. Of course, the downside of that that coming rain is that it'll melt all the snow. And, well, not a lot of place for melted snow to go now that so many of the mountains are gone around here. Probably have a little flooding. By the way, thanks to Snuffy John up in Maine. Love to you and all the Kincaids and all the Horn family. And with that, we are only $175 away from meeting our fundraising goal for the evening. So thank you very much for joining in with Diane, with Sal, Snuffy John. Much appreciated. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, hey, Sandra.
Sandra, what's up?
Oh, well, I'm just sort of wondering, I mean, why is Obama not using income inequality? I mean, it's just, you just have to hang your head and think, wow, you know, it's just never ending with this guy. Ladders of whatever. I mean, it's just some BS. It's like, that is the most potent meme we've had access to in a long time, thanks to Occupy. And, of course, he feels the need to do what? I'm just, you know, that whole thing is just totally, I was just disgusted by the whole thing, if it's true.
Well, I expect it is, and I guess we'll find out in fairly short order. But, this goes back to my theory that he presides from a position of fear. It might piss off Jamie Dimon and the gang on Wall Street,
right.
and they're great buddies, aren't they?
Well, yeah, that person that killed somebody with his yacht, those types of people. I mean, why would you want to be associated with the Perkins of the world? I mean, that guy is in a different planet. I heard his interview, and I was just like, dude, you should have shut the hell up.
The guy who says that being rich now in America is just like being a Jew in Nazi Germany.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's just really in that bubble, and he, you know, I don't know who gave him the okay to print that op-ed, but you know, like I said, I don't know, the rich, they're kind of getting unhinged. It's pretty funny on some levels. You know, that they're so freaked out by just rhetoric. I mean,
and he's 82 years old, for God's sake, Sandra.
Oh, they're going on about the Daniel Steele. It's like, OMG. You know what I'm saying? It's like,
yeah.
No, I'm thinking, listen, you know, the U.S. is kind of slow, you know, with the Justin Bieber and that constant propaganda that we're being fed, but you know, it's kind of bubbling over. You can't have the wealth concentrated like that. You're going to have side effects, you know. And it's interesting, all the Richies coming out of the woodwork bitching and moaning. And then they have their handmaidens, Obama, capitulating. It's like, dude, no one's going to fall over if you say income inequality, except for people who own you.
And see,
all
the talking points leading up to this have been about how he's finally had enough and he's going to start using executive orders, blah, 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 blah. And what?
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, and it's just like, yeah, 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 I don't, you know, I'm not exactly rolling over with the prospects of that bullshit either, because he's already a dictator with his drones and all this. I mean, I'm not interested in him trying to bleed that over into domestic. I don't care if Republicans are running the Congress. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm done with the cult of personality, and, you know, forgive me, but January 2017 just can't get here soon enough. I am so over it.
Oh, you're that excited about President Hillary?
I don't want her either. I find that really disturbing, too. So, you know, I don't know. I just am sort of...
I know, but, I mean, it's, at some point you just kind of go, hey, welcome to the empire. I mean,
well, it's just, you know, she's, you know, the thought of her is just like, please let somebody pop out of the woodwork, because I'm not, I not so much because it's her, but the whole Clinton, Bush, Clinton, you know what I mean?
For me, it's more Sandra, globalist.
Right, especially the Clintons. That's exactly what they have, like, you know, become. So you're right with the, you know, when you hear them, you know, Flash, Bono, and all those types. Mind you, the Davos was very flat this year. I think that, you know, the Kievs of the world, you know, that's what they're scared of.
Well, that's always what they're scared of, because it's
that shit is well out of control.
Well, you've got, did I see that photo right? You've got the cops throwing Molotov cocktails at the protesters now?
Yeah, it's crazy. But, you know, to me, I'm like, you know, I think I tweeted, like, oh, is this an oligarch proxy war? Oh, you know, what's happening? So, because I'm not buying it. All those velvet revolutions, all that bullshit is funded by, you know, states. And you never know what the real deal is. But the imagery is, the optics are bad. I'm like, you know, wow. Because they're doing some really interesting actions over in Kiev, too.
Well, it's making
really interesting use of heavy equipment movers and, you know, stuff like that. Just sort of very creative kind of protests going on. Anyway.
Well, no, I because I'm the cynic that I am, I look at Ukraine, and you know that they've Putin's Russia has courted them so hard for this. This cooperative trade plan thing. I can just kind of see us moving in the background and saying, "Hey, let's put a stick in his spokes." Just, you know, because it's the hegemony game, isn't it?
I think this great power proxy wars at every turn. I mean, Syria, you know, all of these unfortunate places. But you know, never forget with the Syria thing. That global warming, you know, I don't want to say Syria is its first victim because there's been others, but it definitely is a major victim of the global warming because of the year after year drought that forced prosperous farmers into the city to compete with urban workers, and no one had a job, and it all just sort of spiraled from there. I mean, there was other issues, of course, but that was a huge one.
Well, as I've said before, massive unplanned movements of human populations seldom wind up working out well.
Well, and it's just, I don't know, there's this book, oh, God, what is it called? It's written, I think it might be Mike Davis who wrote it, but it's about the sort of environmental destruction that went on, you know, in Ulysses Grant's day. I mean, just that's the time period we're talking.
Yeah.
And, you know, this really massive sort of natural and man-made kind of catastrophes all around the mostly colonized world, you know, China, India, Egypt.
Oh, that's, and, well, that's why that Wall Street Journal story about Eric Prince just filled me with fear and loathing.
Well, yeah, all that is just, yeah, but, you know, we're not hearing Obama calling them a traitor and wanting to bring him back for this, that, and the third, like they are Snowden.
No, he's doing business.
You know, right. It's okay, but it's not okay because and then the sort of, the Prime Minister of Japan actually invoking World War I, that was scary. See, I know Americans don't pay attention. That's part of our problem. But I do. I'm like, the Prime Minister of Japan is talking about his little issue with China is kind of reminding him of right before World War I. Hello?
Yeah, I don't like anybody being reminded of anything right before World War I.
Well, for a prime minister of the second largest economy and a power like that to be nattering on and visiting war memorials and just generally being fascist, it's a bit of a worry.
And again, that's another one of those things, because we're so good at not paying attention. We've had dispatches from Japan pointing out that there really is a nasty bit of nationalism running loose right now.
Well, especially with the islands that they took. You know, I mean, let's be honest. If you want to pick sides, China is perfectly right about what they're talking about. And I'm not like some huge, China cheering, but, I know enough history to know that, well, yeah, they do actually have a point. But it don't never make any sense to dumbass Americans, because they don't know anything. So, and we sit around here just whatever, looking at I'm sorry to keep going to Justin Bieber, but I cannot believe how that sort of enveloped the media. I thought, oh my God.
Well, did you see that clip of Andrea Mitchell?
Yeah, that's like classic now. That is classic. That bitch stopped her talking to. Now I hate that woman. She was Harmon. She's a fascist too. But it was like, hello, you're gonna stop this, the policymaker and interject that bullshit? That was outrageous, wasn't it?
Oh, I sat there. I thought it was a funny.
No, it was.
But it wasn't. It was one of those Rod Serling signposts on the way to where the hell ever.
It was really a good. Signpost. That's the best way. Because I was just like.
Because if you're a responsible broadcast journalist with the stature that she has, okay, and we can save the nature of that stature for another conversation, I think. But don't you have the power to wave off the voice in your ear going, no? I mean, would they just can her if she said, I refuse to talk about Justin Bieber? I'm in the middle of something here.
I mean. It's just infotainment. The news, when all those journalists were scurrying in the early 80s, they saw what was coming down the pike. And here we are with, what, is it two companies that control all the media now, or is it five?
I thought it was six, but...
Well, okay, but, it was 50 in 1983. Let's just use that as a floor.
And 50's not exactly a great big number in the first place.
No, it's not, but we're talking, for 30 years, 50 to 6 is pretty drastic. And, it's just, that is why, and it's horrible because the media is protected by law, but it wasn't protected to have this shit doled out to us 24/7. I mean.
Well, CNN went to almost, non-stop Bieber coverage, didn't they?
Yeah.
I mean, they just completely sold out.
It's just embarrassing. I mean, but it's even over the top for your non-pulse America. I mean, I think they really did sort of jump the shark with it, because it's Justin Bieber. Hello. What the hell?
And he is soundly... I mean, my barometer is Ferg. Ferg despises Justin Bieber.
Oh, listen, even the girls fisheye him. They're like in the demographic. So, that's my, One Direction is all okay all day, every day. But Katy Perry is too old.
Yep.
They said, ew, isn't she almost 30? I was like, OMG on this.
Yeah, get my shroud.
Right, I'm like, well, damn, they must think I'm just, something decrepit, but that's another...
Well, you're supposed to be. You're the auntie.
I know, but I'm like, Katie, I didn't think that... But she out of the mix, so... but they're not keen on him either,
Miley?
I just don't understand, what's happening, because at the same time, the sort of emerging... The financial system of the emerging markets, I don't know if you've noticed, it's kind of falling apart, and I think
they bravely tried to call that a correction the other day, but that was just going in the tank 2%, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, but worse is that they so-called fighting inflation by raising their interest rates from what was at 3% to 8%. they pull in a Volcker, because that's what Volcker did over in this motherfucker to kill wage growth and unions. You know that. That's why when I see Volcker, I'm like, fuck you. He's a horror show. And they always roll him out as some sort of moderate voice that's there to control the financial system. I'm like, bitch, you remember he raised the interest rates to 18% in this motherfucker? Crickets. We're only talking 30 years ago, you know, or 35 years ago.
Yeah, that was during the Carter presidency, wasn't it?
Yeah. But once again, it's like, you know, how short is the memory in this place?
And yet, we are of a certain age, Sandra. You remember it. I was a kid. I remember, because I remember my parents sitting around talking about how there we were in our little 1959 brick three-bedroom home that they had busted their asses to pay off, and they wanted a better place. But my parents looked at each other and said, no way are we going to go out and get a home loan at 18%.
Right, so it's just, but anyway, that's what the emerging markets are, that's the tool they have, and this is all because the Fed has tapered from buying $85 billion, creating that much money out of thin air to creating $69 billion every month. So just that drop is just unleashing all sorts of hell around the world. And you have to think, well, the system is real flim-flam if that's all it takes.
Yeah, that's not even a real good hard shove.
Scary. No, but it's really disturbing. And the Fed is like, They're not gonna stop the tapering, which, I can understand why. I mean, how many years has it been? QE 1, 2, 3, 6, what? So, it's scary, because Argentina that's looking like 2003 again, or whenever they had that last sort of, well, we're not paying our debts, fuck you very much, period, that they did. They're about to do something again like that.
Well, but the thing is, this thing keeps playing games with exponential mathematics and concepts of compounding, and nobody can ever get free of it, can they? I mean, isn't that the nature of the design?
Well, no, that's the thing. That's why the neoliberal model is destined to just have some sort of humongous explosion, because in human history, that jubilee, that's for real. And there's a good reason for it. It's a reset. Every period in human history, you see some sort of debt jubilee. That's not made up. That's done for a reason. And yet we have this system here that is, going to hold debtors to what? At some point, you order water cannons, which is what the UK is doing right now. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be sardonic. I'm just kind of like...
No, I get it, because, sardonic. I mean, with what's been going on here, the question I keep asking is, what does it take to get 300,000 poisoned people into the streets? And apparently we haven't found it yet.
Yeah, I don't understand. That's another one that's a real, I don't know, it's Anita Baker, it's a mystery.
And when this one person who tweeted to me said, Aaron Brockovich is on the case... I appreciate her commitment, Ms. Brockovich's commitment to, righting civil justice wrongs, but that's no help. That's no help when your kid's got leukemia 10 years from now.
No, it's more power to her, but, these are structural concerns and powerlessness that is being put on display here. Goodness. But I see that your show's about to go off.
So we are. You watch the clock better than I do. I enjoy our conversations.
Oh, well, no football talk, but hopefully I'll catch up with you before the big game.
Yeah, we need to have a pre-Super Bowl breakdown, I think. Oh, by the way, did you see that, before we go, did you see that the Northwestern football team is petitioning to organize a union?
Yeah, that shit is on. I'll keep my eye out on that. I saw that. Yep.
That's got potential to be a, game changer. Sandra, have a good evening, and happy belated birthday.
All right. Bye.
Bye. that's Sandra, and I've run out of time, so I'm just going to end it this way, so that Rick Smith can get busy. He's on the way. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for your kind contributions to help keeping all of this going. We will begin tomorrow evening at 325, I guess, $325 for fundraising. Thanks to all of you who spend your time with us. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, and thanks to Cold River Mountain Watch. Good night.